Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, institutional money eyes water infrastructure as the next big frontier. Why better rest could reshape health and economics. Potato prices tumble, consumers cheer while farmers feel the squeeze. And Australia moves on social media. Will South Africa be next? It's Thursday, the 9th of October. Now, I think it's fair to say that Africa's water crisis broadly is deepening, yet some see it as an untapped investment frontier. At the recent AU-AIP Water Investment Summit, leaders pledging something in the region of $30 billion US dollars a year to secure the continent's water future. Well, I'm going to talk now to development finance specialist David Sawyer in the United States. He says the challenge is converting those promises into real bankable projects, and obviously that makes sense. David, a very warm welcome to you. In many respects, the continent's water infrastructure is either collapsing or is non-existent. Isn't the risk just too high to invest in it?
Thank you for having me, Jeremy. So I think there is a structural tension that is created by water being a public good, basically a human right, and the ability of end users to pay, right? So while the sector is risky, there are ways in which we can monetize and capitalize investments, right? So the challenge often arises from end users not being able to pay a cost-reflective tariff to the government, right? And on the other hand, investors are looking for certain criteria to be able to make the water sector investable. So, for example, you know, there is weak municipal balance sheets, unclear revenue models, a payment culture that is basically aging infrastructure. So I think there's a couple of things that need to happen to be able to reduce the water sector from being risky. We need to better manage our assets. We need better policies. We need performance-based financing. So yes, you are right that the sector is quite risky, but there are ways to de-risk the sector.
So let's talk about better policies then. How difficult is it to de-risk water projects in countries where there is weak governance and, as you've referred to, unreliable revenue collection?
Yeah, so I think there is a question of building institutional capacity, right? So at the municipal level, most of the multilateral development banks, including the one I work for, have programs and facilities that provide technical assistance and grants to be able to strengthen municipal institutional capacity, right? So that means that from the engineering and infrastructure side of things, there is financing being provided so that these governments will be able to monitor water leaks, monitor infrastructure quality across the pipeline all the way to the last mile. On the upper hand, municipalities need to improve their balance sheets, need to be able to adequately manage their finances, right? So there are ways in which we can improve institutional quality to be able to de-risk and improve corporate governance across the sector.
Development finance generally loves the language of partnership. I think that is fair to say. But what happens when private partners chase profit that is often at odds with the public need and water sits firmly in that descriptor?
Yeah. So I think you're right that private partners look for profits and returns, but there is different levels of capital to access. At the top level, you've got development financial institutions, the likes of DBSA, African Development Bank, IFC, World Bank, and a bunch of others, who typically are able to provide concessional financing. In the middle, You've got philanthropies, you've got NGOs, you've got family offices who are able to provide patient capital to invest into these projects. They're not seeking immediate returns. They have a fund life of, 20, 30, 40 years. And then you've got 100% private capital in the third layer who are looking for immediate returns. So this is where the question of partnerships, private partnerships come into question. This is where blended finance comes into question, where we need a financing model that structures in all of these parties. So you've got the DFIs on the one hand, you've got what we call the sort of mezzanine investors, which is the philanthropies, NGOs, foundations, and then you've got the pure commercial banks seeking returns. So you need to blend all these three into a financing model that allocates risks depending on the risk appetite of each of the investor class.
I understand the concept of blended finance, but who really takes the first loss when a project fails? Is it the taxpayer or the private sector?
So in this case, it would be neither the taxpayer nor the private sector. It would be the supranational, so the DFIs, right? So the DFIs, such as, the World Bank, African Development Bank, are able to take that first loss because they provide concessional financing. In most instances, they also sometimes provide a first loss layer, which means that losses up to a certain amount is absorbed by them. And only beyond that can either be absorbed by the taxpayers or by the private sector. So I think that's the true model of blended finance that has been used in places like South America, where the taxpayers don't take the hit of a failed project.
David, the success of any project like this does depend on process, because investors rightly want measurable outcomes. But it's difficult, isn't it, to ensure accountability sometimes when audits and enforcement in some countries barely function?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I think we're moving to a world now where investors don't just give you $100 million and walk away. They give you $100 million and they want to sort of monitor how and where that funding is implemented. And now we've come up with this sort of disbursement that are tied to measurable outcomes, right? So you've got, for example, in South Africa, you've got the blue and green drop scores, which can be linked to investments, right? So if a high blue drop rating is obtained, then that incentivizes the investors to release more funding, right? So we basically develop a disbursement system that is linked to measurable outcomes, and that increases accountability.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. David Sawyer in the United States, talking to me from Washington, D.C. He is a development finance specialist. David, I appreciate your time and your insight.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, there's a new number on the health balance sheet, and it's sleep. A major study from Discovery Vitality shows that poor sleep doesn't just affect well-being. It drives up healthcare costs, it worsens productivity, and even raises the risk of costly road accidents. With sleep disorders on the rise and insurers now treating sleep like a measurable health behavior, the economic case for building better sleep is there. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Mosima Mabunda, who's Chief Clinical Officer at Vitality. Dr. Mabunda, a very warm welcome to you. Is the subtext here that South Africans don't get enough sleep?
Jeremy, that is the subtext as well. But just to caveat it, it's not just South Africa. Globally, we are not sleeping as well as we should. So this is something that is important not only for us, but also for everyone else across the globe.
And the reason for it is what?
So good question, Jeremy. So a couple of factors. I think the one that I want to start with is our environments are not geared to support us to sleep well, right? So many people lie in bed watching TV. Many people do activities that stimulate them instead of letting them wind down. The daily choices we make day to day as well influences whether we sleep or not. Some people occasionally over dinner, you'll have wine, and we know the effects of alcohol on sleep, but also medical conditions can impact our ability to sleep. So it is multifactorial, but the reason I started with the first two is there are things within our environment and in the choices we make every day that actually hamper our ability to sleep well.
Why do you think it's taken such a long time to get this debate onto the agenda?
So I am glad you're asking. So I think a couple of reasons why now this is the time, right? So right now, the science is undeniable. In the past 5 odd years, there's been compelling data that shows the link between sleep and the major health outcomes we care about. So that's one. Secondly, and I'll speak more also from a discovery perspective, is we also have a program where members track their activity through their devices. Members are now starting to sleep with their devices, and we've got a rich data set of sleep data, over 47 million sleep nights with over 100,000 members tracking their sleep without us even incentivizing it. That's another key source of insights that informs the decisions we make. But I think lastly as well, Jeremy, the technology is in a space where it allows for us to not only know and track, but to start innovating for solutions that help individuals not only know their sleep, but start to make inroads to actually improve their sleep.
I'm wondering whether you break that data down demographically in terms of age and gender and the like. Do you have a better picture of who's sleeping well and who's sleeping badly?
So what I can say is across the board, people are not sleeping well. However, some of the interesting snippets from our data, we see that young career males don't have as great sleep, and one can have numerous hypotheses to say, is it career, etc. And also older females, 55, 60, but we know that as people get older, their sleep starts to become a little bit challenging. But overall, what we see is people are generally not sleeping well. And the one thing I want to add there is, if you look at the components of sleep, because sleep is more than the hours we spend in bed, sleep encompasses not only duration, but also quality, which includes your deep and REM sleep, and also regularity, which is important. We see that regularity is where many people struggle and fall short. And our data shows us that the one metric that impacts your health and health outcomes the most out of all of them is regularity.
So you make a very strong case. Is there an economic cost of poor sleep to the health system and the economy as a whole?
So definitely, yes. I mean, externally, there's research that's been published there, but even within our data, right, what we've shown with our colleagues from Discovery Health is if individuals improve sleep, you can reduce in hospital claims by 7%. We also know that poor sleep, those individuals that sleep less than 7 hours and have irregular sleep, have a higher risk of mortality. That's 22%. So you can see from those stats that there definitely is an economic case, and that's partly why it made sense for us as a business to invest there. We also know that those individuals that don't sleep as well have a higher risk of getting diabetes. That's like sitting between 60 and 70%. That is high. We also know the bi-directional relationship between sleep and depression, to name a few. So long way of answering your question, definitely yes.
Do you ultimately see sleep as becoming a key productivity lever in the corporate wellness space?
I definitely do. I actually would go as far as saying, like, sleep is not just a pillar, but it's a foundational determinant of health. And one of the recommendations we have in the sleep factor report at the back is recommendations for employers to say this needs to be prioritized. Because right now, what we've spoken about, Jeremy, some of the medium to long term of chronic poor sleep. But we know that even in the short term, sleep has immediate impact on how our brains function and our ability to show up the next day. So the importance of the programs like what we have, where we incentivize our members through Vitality Sleep Rewards so that they can focus on sleeping well every single day, is actually quite important.
Do you think that you'll be able to shift the way, though, that employers structure health benefits and wellness programs? Or do you think it might still be a bit of a stretch?
Jeremy, I am an ambitious person. That is my ambition. I have seen that employers actually genuinely care, to be honest. I've seen that employers generally approach us to ask for ways that they can bolster their wellness program. So I would not be surprised if this conversation continues beyond sleep. And we've had a few employers that were in the audience on Tuesday when we launched the Sleep Factor report, because we wanted to expose them firsthand to the research, because I would not be surprised if they actually get on the bandwagon, because fortunately, unfortunately, you don't have a choice. If you genuinely care about the well-being of your staff, which many employers do, you would want to ensure you cover all of the metrics that influences risk and can impact productivity.
Dr. Mosima Mabunda, Chief Clinical Officer at Vitality, thank you very much for joining us today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, potato prices, I read, are tumbling after 2 years of relentless increases, with new industry data showing a sharp correction as a surge in planting is meeting favorable weather. The upshot, well, I understand the market is now flooded and prices could fall to around R3.50 a kilogram this month. That would be well below production costs. For farmers, obviously, that's a serious blow, but for us consumers, I guess some long-awaited relief at the till. The question, of course, is how long is this slump going to last and whether it threatens the stability of one of South Africa's most important staple crops. I'm in conversation now from Potatoes SA with FP Kutsia. FP, a very warm welcome. You've warned that prices will be, and I quote, below production cost in coming months. Maybe just give us an idiot's guide to the cost structure. What's the break-even price per kilogram and how far below do you expect it to go?
Thank you, Jeremy. Okay, so let's start first. About 85% of potatoes in South Africa are planted under irrigation. And that is a very expensive crop to plant, and it costs about R300,000 per hectare. So it all depends, when you talk about break-even price, it all depends on the yield that you get and how well you can manage your input costs. So anything from R45 even to R50 if in terms of a 10 kilogram pocket, or R450 to R500 a kilo.
This price collapse, do you think then it threatens the viability of future planting decisions for farmers in coming seasons? How serious is it?
Yeah, well, this is a very serious issue for us, because it's a very difficult crop to plant, and it's not everyone that can plant a potato. You need experience. So, and we only have about 500 farmers. So if this price continues, there's definitely some farmers that's going to leave the potato industry. So the farmers are getting less and less, and that puts some pressure on longevity of the potato industry.
It's not only longevity of the industry, FP. I would imagine this has a domino effect on jobs in the sector.
Yeah, the microeconomy in the platteland is coming under pressure, because we all know that the farming industry as a whole is the backbone of these smaller towns.
So, first of all, maybe just tell me how big the oversupply is. Are you able to quantify that?
The issue with the oversupply is not the overall quantities. Our five-year average is about 250 million 10-kilogram pockets, or 2.5 million tons. The issue is oversupply in short spaces of time, and that puts pressure on the price and on the market. So the oversupply currently, the region that's in the market is Limpopo. They have about 80% market share when they come into the market. And we expect that there will be around about 12 to 13 million 10 kilogram pockets in oversupply.
So with such an oversupply, FP, is there a risk now that farmers either discard produce that is wasting, maybe they let crops rot? What's the plan going forward and how do they mitigate against that?
So the strategy actually is to keep the lower classes, class 4, class 3, from the market, the fresh produce market floor, because it's getting hot, it's going to rot on the market floor in any way, and send only the quality, the best crop to the market. We also have a strategy where we ask farmers to send the crop that you can't market because it's not feasible. Send it to some of these people that give it to school feeding programs so that they can have food. To the people that don't have food or the ability to buy food, there's a lot of programs like that, and we ask farmers to give it to them rather than to just throw it away.
And FP, I'm wondering to myself if this current situation is going to lead producers to shift maybe to alternative crops or investments. They must be thinking along those lines. If that's the case, what are realistic substitutes?
It's not that easy, because the capital input for potatoes is a long-term input. So if you decide you're going to plant potatoes, you're in it for the long run, because it's very expensive. Back lines, harvesters, planters, and all that. So it's not easy to exit. But if they want to exit, it depends on where in the country they are. It's, let's say, Eastern Free State. They have the dryland option of soybeans and maize. Limpopo, they don't really have another option than planting potatoes. There's a little bit of onions being planted there and some other veggies. but not a lot of choice. If you're a potato plant farmer, you're mainly a potato farmer.
Are there export opportunities?
Currently, we export to our neighbors, Mozambique, Botswana, a little bit to Zimbabwe. Also, some potatoes go to Namibia, even to Angola. But we're working very hard to get new export opportunities. And if we're lucky enough, I believe from March this year, we will be able to export some potatoes to the Russian Federation.
FP, you mentioned that retailers have got to pass on the price drop to consumers. And I'm wondering whether that is going to happen or is happening. What kind of levers exist to ensure that the full benefit reaches consumers?
Conversations like this is very important, and conversations directly with the retailers. Our leader, Willy Jacobs, he had conversations with all the big retailers to make sure that they have the right information, to make sure they know what's going on in the market, and hopefully that this lower price passes on to the end consumer. So, yeah, that's one of the levers that we use, good information and insights.
What kind of response have you had from the retailers?
A very positive response. The bigger retailers has an increase, or told us they had an increase in their sales. A lot of specials is in the retail space right now. But then you also get some of the smaller shops. If I can use an example, I got a photo from a farmer yesterday showing me that his mom paid 160 rand for a 10 kilogram pocket, and that's unacceptable. So we're asking the listeners, please send us those photos if you get pockets that's expensive like that, and we will go and talk to them.
So what kind of leverage could you exercise over someone who is either not lowering the price or is taking advantage?
We expose them, telling the industry about them maybe, or talk to them directly, maybe find out what's the reason for that. And hopefully, if you start a conversation, maybe they don't know. We start a conversation, start with good information, and yeah, we'll take it from there.
And just a final one, I wonder if there's a role for government, or when it comes to maybe procurement or storage or processing intervention, to help stabilize prices.
South Africa is very fortunate. We have fresh produce potatoes all year round. We have 16 regions. We plant potatoes and harvest potatoes all year round. So in our country, it won't be feasible to store potatoes because it will add to the cost for end consumer. So I don't think in our picture that makes sense.
And that's where we are going to leave it. Thank you very much indeed for that explanation. That is FP Kutsia from Potatoes South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you might have heard that Australia is moving quickly to ban under-16s from social media. From December, platforms are going to have to verify ages or face heavy fines. Tech companies say the ban is unworkable, it's easy to bypass. Governments say it's about protecting children. So, obviously, the legal battles have already begun and the world is watching. So let's take a broad look at this issue and maybe even a South African perspective. And digital law expert Emma Sadler from the Digital Law Company is with me now. Emma, how legally solid is this ban in Australia likely to be?
Well, I'm so happy you're talking about this. And I think that it is legally solid. I think that there are problems with enforcement. They brought out the law at the end of last year, Jeremy, and the effective date is the 10th of December this year. So there was 1 year for compliance for tech companies to get their house in order and to work out how they're going to try to comply with this law. And I have to say, from a big picture point of view, I'm delighted, because I think that this idea that the age of internet adulthood should be 13 is a mad idea. Anyone who's got a 13-year-old would know that's the time they should be kept away from social media, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, in the most strident way. But I think that it's to be welcomed in terms of just getting the conversation started between parents and children. What age is appropriate for these apps? And of course, we know there's going to be workarounds, but I think it's a jolly good start.
Let's get to those workarounds in just a moment. But do you sense then, or you may be suggesting, that this could be a little more symbolic than effective?
Yes, I think, well, we know that, you know, for me, it's a bit analogous to banning alcohol. You can ban alcohol and say that it's illegal for people under the age of 18 to drink alcohol, but at least, and then we know that there are a lot of children under the age of 18 who do go out and successfully get alcohol, whether it's using fake IDs or older siblings or whatever workaround. But at least it creates, Jeremy, a societal norm, which is that children under the age of 18 shouldn't be drinking alcohol. So it creates exceptions rather than the norm. You know, I think that one of the biggest issues that parents face is the societal pressure, the peer pressure, that your child comes home in grade 4, 5, 6 and says, but mummy, I'm the only one not on the WhatsApp group, and I'm being left out and I'm being socially excluded. Now, that really is a reason for you to get your child a phone, a device, get them access to social media, because nobody wants their child to feel left out. So if we can shift that norm to, well, actually, these places aren't appropriate. And I can tell you, I'm the first responder when things go wrong in South Africa with children. And they are going horribly wrong. I mean, I can't even tell you the kind of content that these children are exposed to. If we just look at the average age of first exposure to pornography, I think what we're dealing with is more like 9 years old at the moment. And so if we can start getting that conversation, because I think that the world has been slow to wake up about the harms of social media on children. And I think if we can kind of get that collective action and collective think going about, well, if I've got a nine-year-old who's scrolling on TikTok and not going to sleep at night unless they're falling asleep in front of YouTube, maybe things are going a little bit wrong. And Jeremy, I know we're talking about Australia, but I have to tell you that in France, there have just been recommendations made to a parliamentary commission there. And there are a few features there that I loved. They're talking about introducing overnight digital curfews for 15 to 18-year-olds. So no social media between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., having a ban on mobile phones in schools. That's something we're seeing around the world. And one of the most fabulous things is the introduction in the coming years, the proposal of creating a crime of digital negligence, where parents who are allowing their children to be brought up quite literally by their devices, well, actually saying, well, maybe that's not the best idea.
Emma, let's go back to your argument about, or the point you made about workarounds, and let me maybe extend your alcohol analogy a little bit. Surely teens are just going to find different ways, for instance, use VPNs to bypass the system.
Well, we saw that in July, Jeremy, because the UK brought out the Online Safety Act. And we saw in the week following that, which basically meant that if you wanted to access adult sites, you had to submit a government-issued identity document or a credit card, because credit cards are only available to people over the age of 18. And it was amazing because the number one downloaded app for the next few weeks were VPN apps. So the official stat was there was a 1,400% increase in VPN usage in 1 week. So yes, there are workarounds. There's been a big study done by the University of Melbourne and by Princeton University testing these age estimation tools. Basically what Australia said is there are three ways you can do it. You can either have an age estimation tool, which is when something inside your computer, inside your phone, scans and analyzes your face and decides whether or not you're old enough. So they were showing in the study that if you put on a mask, an old man's mask, you can quickly get around it. Or if you show a picture on your phone into the camera on your computer, you can get around it. Now, we know that there are going to be workarounds. The second thing is to provide official ID. And then, of course, people said if you just Googled a driver's license example and submitted the fake one that you find on the internet, that worked. And then the other thing, which I think is probably the most effective, is age inference. So platforms can guess a person's age using the existing data that they have on them. So for me, I'm a mum, I've got two kids. So there's a lot of stuff around children, they would know that I'm old enough to have children from what I look at, and then they would be able to assess that I'm older. You know, if you suddenly an old man mask access this content and then you're very interested in K-pop demon hunters or something, which is really for the tweens, then you would realize there was a problem. So of course it's not flawless. I think there's, you know, we know there are so many workarounds, but I think it's just so cool, Jeremy, that people are finally saying, okay, enough of this idea that our children are exposed to the kinds of harmful content. The French report I referred to earlier said that TikTok knowingly exposes children to toxic, dangerous, and addictive content, and that it's a production line of distress and a spiral of harmful content. I told you, I'm on the ground. I can confirm that's exactly what we're seeing. So I think it's to be welcomed. I just want to quickly say one of my favorite things about it, if we carry on with the alcohol analogy, is that in South Africa, if a teenager goes and buys alcohol, then the teenager is committing a criminal offence. And the way the Australian law is formulated is that it would be the company committing an offence and would have to pay a fine to the Australian government. And the fines are huge, up to 30 million Australian dollars, if they make that platform available. So it's almost a reverse onus. It's saying the companies must do something to comply with this law rather than making the 12-year-old who's got the TikTok account a criminal.
And Emma, just a quick one in conclusion, is there an appetite for this debate in South Africa right now? And if we tried something similar, would it face onerous constitutional hurdles?
So I don't think it would face onerous constitutional hurdles. I think it would pass constitutional muster. I would love to have a similar law in South Africa. And in fact, we've been working on one in my company, a draft law. The real problem, Jeremy, will come in with how do we enforce it? Because we've already got this very serious problem of international tech companies basically saying, oh, we don't have to comply with South African law because we don't have jurisdiction in South Africa. If you think about Poppy and the information regulator saying to WhatsApp, saying to Snap, TikTok, how are you complying with Poppy? They don't give a damn about Poppy. And until our government is strong enough to stand up and say, okay, well, if you don't comply with South African laws, we're going to cut you off in South Africa, then they'll just carry on doing whatever the hell they want.
Emma Sadler, thank you very much indeed from the Digital Law Company. And that is where we're going to log out of this conversation. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.